This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, April 24th, 2024. I'm Caleb Brown. Advocates of an ongoing warrantless surveillance state won a round in Congress, as federal surveillance authorities have now been extended for 2 years and in some ways made worse for Americans' liberties. The fight for requiring warrants before the feds can go snooping through Americans' data, among other reforms, now moves back to the courts, at least as far as the Cato Institute is concerned. Cato's Patrick Eddington explains what happened. Pat, I want to set the stage with an event that you point to in a blog post that you wrote, in which an FBI agent searched campaign donors of a particular congressional campaign among thousands, tens of thousands of other searches, with essentially what appeared to be no oversight. And this is all private information. This is warrantless surveillance of Americans. And it's not clear that that surveillance had anything to do with even a suspicion of a crime.
Caleb, this is what happens when government bureaucrats, in this case, law enforcement government bureaucrats, are given vast investigative powers without any kind of meaningful oversight whatsoever. And in this whole recently concluded, for now, battle over the reauthorization of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, I think many of us thought that that incident that you just described, which involved no less than 19,000 U.S. person donors to a congressional campaign, I think a lot of us thought, okay, that has to be it. That's got to be the one that motivates Congress to actually finally impose a warrant requirement on any searches of the stored communications of Americans collected under this FISA Section 702 program. And in fact, in December of 2023, the House Judiciary Committee passed a bill out of that committee 35-2. You don't see that kind of bipartisanship generally on Capitol Hill these days, that not only included a warrant requirement for said searches, but also included a ban on agencies like the FBI, DEA, ATF, et cetera, from simply going to data brokers to get similar data, you know, just simply using taxpayer dollars to buy it. And I think a lot of us who work these constitutional issues were at that moment of the opinion that we might actually win this time. We might actually finally kind of put this genie somewhat back in the bottle. And unfortunately, as we of course now know, that's not how it turned out. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, Title VII of it, which includes the Section 702 program we're discussing, was set to expire at 12:01 a.m. on January 1st, 2024. And Speaker Johnson and his allies in the House and the Senate managed to get an extension to April 19th, 2024. And all of that happened because reformers were on the verge of being able to bring that very good reform bill that I talked about to the floor over the speaker's objections. So the surveillance state advocates bought themselves 4 months. They used those 4 months to fearmonger relentlessly. And in the end, they got what they wanted.
So let's understand this a little better in terms of what reformers were asking for. We have a vast amount of data about Americans that is collected by intelligence agencies and law enforcement in the United States, all without a warrant. Let's be clear about that. But the warrant requirement that reformers were seeking would have required a probable cause warrant for the feds to search the information that they had already collected. The White House essentially dismiss this out of hand. They view this as in the words of the White House, a functionally unworkable solution to the problem of abuse of surveillance power,
which itself was a demonstrably false statement, right? Because every day in this country, literally every day, in a normal domestic criminal context, if the Justice Department wants to go and engage in surveillance of an American who is believed to be engaged in criminal conduct or on the verge of engaging in criminal conduct, they don't get to just go and collect the data and then search through it, to their heart's content. They have to go to a judge and demonstrate that they have probable cause to believe that a crime has been or is about to be committed. And that's what makes this entire Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act setup, you know, so fraught. When it was originally passed in 1978, the primary purpose of this law was to gather information on foreigners, primarily for counterintelligence purposes, you know, catching spies, essentially. That's what it was really supposed to be all about. And in terms of, you know, going after Americans who might be in contact with a Russian or a Chinese intelligence operative, the requirement was you have to go and get a warrant in order to, you know, once you've developed data on the foreigner indicating that they are, in fact, an agent of a foreign power, you then have to get a warrant in order to get a tap or whatever on the communications of the American party in that context. And what has happened, of course, in the post-9/11 environment is that this FISA Section 702 program actually began as a completely illegal, 100% illegal, warrantless surveillance program that was initiated literally hours after the 9/11 attacks by then National Security Agency Director Michael Hayden. He told his people to simply start collecting every bit of data flowing between the United States and Afghanistan. Didn't make any distinctions about whether or not it was clearly foreign-related or U.S.-related, and that was just a flat-out violation of FISA. And once this was surfaced by the New York Times in December 2005, it sparked a 2.5-year battle to make that illegal Stellar Wind program, that was the code name for it, into something that would actually be passably legal. And that's how we get the FISA Amendments Act, which of course contains the Section 702 program. And in that program, they are allowed literally to collect data over the telecommunications system. They go directly to the providers, let's say AT&T, Verizon, whatever, for kind of the point-to-point data. And then for traffic that's in transit, they go against the internet backbone, what's called upstream collection, and they get a lot of the data that way. So, you know, what we found over the course of the 15, going on 16 years that this program has been in existence is that it has been serially abused. There were over 3 million U.S. person queries conducted by the FBI just 3 years ago. Now, they claim that these internal reforms that they have implemented, that this new legislation, this H.R. 7888 that was passed by the House and the Senate and that President Biden signed on April 20th, 2024, allegedly institutionalizes or makes statutory these reforms that the FBI has allegedly implemented, which just 2 years ago resulted in a mere, you know, 278,000 U.S. person queries. I think all of us who work these issues from a civil society standpoint are deeply skeptical that these reforms are really actually going to have the kind of effect that the advocates who push this bill believe they will. But time will tell. I will say there are some interesting and potentially useful things in this legislation. And one of those is Section 9, which is a mandatory audit by the Department of Justice's Inspector General that must be completed and made public within 180 days of the passage of this thing. So in other words, they're, you know, about 6 months out from the next reauthorization, we're going to have this report. And they also create this FISA Reform Commission that will allegedly look at, you know, a lot of these other things. But the plain fact of the matter is, a warrant requirement is absolutely workable. There is no question that it's workable. It, you know, 5 years ago, almost 6 years ago now, Director Wray went to the FISA court, and we got this through the Freedom of Information Act via litigation, what I'm about to discuss. Director Wray went to the court and FISA court and basically said, oh, there's no way that we can, you know, possibly tell you, you know, how many of these queries are exclusively U.S. person or how many of these are just strictly foreigners, all the rest of that. The FISA court didn't buy it. They told him to do it. And of course, the FBI was able to do it. And that's one of the ways that we know that their claims that, oh, we just can't do, you know, separation of these warrant requirements and all the rest of that is just going to be unworkable. That's just, I mean, to be blunt, it's a lie.
Let's understand when someone like Christopher Wray says functionally unworkable, or I believe this specifically came from a White House spokesman, that phrase, what they mean is we'll make our jobs more difficult as we comply with the most basic elements of the U.S. Bill of Rights.
Yes. When Jake Sullivan, President Biden's national security advisor, made the statement that you're talking about, I had quite a bit to say about that. I think that's been the history of all of this, right? What law enforcement wants is basically an absolutely unencumbered pathway to go after people. And that's not what the founders intended. They intended to have a standard. And in this case, the standard is supposed to be the Fourth Amendment. And simply stated, it's like this: no probable cause, no warrants, no exceptions. That's how it should work. But it's not working that way. And a lot of this really, I think, Caleb, comes down to the fact that you have essentially an army of taxpayer-funded lobbyists that help to make all this possible. These are the folks that work in the government affairs departments at the FBI, the Department of Justice, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, the National Security Agency, CIA, and so on. And combined with the other taxpayer-funded lobbyists in the public affairs shops, between the two of them, they work the Hill, they work Congress, and they work the press in order to convince people that if you don't let the FBI do this kind of thing, this is going to be a real world 24 with Jack Bauer. We're all going to die in 5 minutes, et cetera, et cetera. And it's always been false. And I think, you know, for me, one of the greatest frustrations is we have ample evidence from other programs that have been terminated after they were claimed to be by federal officials to be totally, absolutely essential to national security. The Stellar Wind program was the first one. The second one was the Patriot Act, Section 215 telephone metadata program. Never stopped a single terror attack on America. Mass surveillance is not how you stop terror attacks. Precise intelligence on specific individuals and specific plots is how you do it. And the idea that it's completely acceptable to just vacuum up this stuff digitally, store it for 5 years at least, which is what they're allowed to do right now, it makes for sloppy intelligence and law enforcement work as far as I'm concerned. And I think the evidence of that, you know, we have seen over the last 15 years with all the abuses that this program has been responsible for.
So there are some interesting things that we'll be able to learn perhaps in the coming years as these programs roll on. But as has been noted by you and others, there are ways in which these surveillance authorities have gotten worse.
And I think, Caleb, what we really have to be concerned about is the longer this stuff is allowed to both grow and go on, the more it becomes a permanent part of the fabric of our political life, our social life, and it has the effect of completely deforming, essentially, what is supposed to be a constitutional republic. That's always been my objection to these kinds of things, in that when we had the Patriot Act passed in 2001, October 2001, it had 16 provisions, in technical terms, are called sunsets, essentially expiration dates, right? As of today, that number is zero. Now, in 2020, three of those provisions that were never really used and should never have been included in the legislation to begin with, they were allowed to expire. And 4 years on, absolutely nothing terrible has happened. All of us predicted nothing terrible would happen. But the other 13 provisions are still law, and that includes things like these sneak and peek searches where they can basically go in and put bugs in your house and everything else and run this stuff against you. And unless they decide, you know, ultimately to indict you, you'll never know it, right? That's just one of the components, essentially, of these surveillance expansions that have happened over the course of the last 20 plus years. And the longer this stuff goes on without being truly revisited in an in-depth way, in a holistic way, the more it becomes, I think, next to impossible to kind of roll it all back and kind of restore the balance, if you will, the actual constitutional balance that's required to have a functioning republic.
A few months ago, Rand Paul, one of the chief opponents of the currently structured surveillance authorities, mentioned that, look, this is a few months of an extension. The authorities that were extended this time in April of 2024 is for multiple years. So I wonder, what other abuses might we learn about that have been going on, and will they have the same salience in 2 years when these authorities come back up for a vote?
I think that concern is absolutely valid, because in contrast to when this particular law was originally enacted in 2008 and renewed in 2012 and 2018, in each of those circumstances where the renewals were taking place, it was basically for 5 years. This time, reformers managed to get it cut down to 2 years. In retrospect, I think in some ways it could backfire. And the reason I say that is, if the FBI is able to essentially bamboozle the Department of Justice's Inspector General into believing that they have continued to successfully reduce the number of U.S. person query incidents, inappropriate or essentially I would describe as unlawful query incidents. And the IG comes out and says, yes, the trend line is good in terms of the reduction of this stuff. Then when we're back here in April of 2026, my prediction is people like Tom Cotton, Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, Marco Rubio, if he is not vice president of the United States at the time, that's a different story how that might happen. But if Senator Rubio is at that point in time, let's say the chairman of the Intelligence Committee in the Senate, you will see a push to make the 702 authority permanent. It'll go away. So that's, I think, the issue. And even if there are additional abuses that are uncovered with this particular program, you know, will it be enough? Will they be radical enough, egregious enough to actually push members in the House and the Senate, you know, to finally agree to a warrant requirement and other reforms that I think are absolutely necessary? I don't know. What I do know is that we are continuing to fight here at Cato. We are still in federal court trying to surface the FBI's own internal FISA Section 702 query audits. Just a reminder to folks that this is the FBI investigating itself. I'm deeply skeptical that that data is going to show good things necessarily, if it's remotely honest in any way. So we're still fighting on that, and we're going to continue to fight in court where necessary, using the Freedom of Information Act to try to surface information on other programs that have absolutely been abused. I've talked about the FBI's use of the so-called assessment authority, which allows them to open a de facto investigation with no criminal predicate. We have seen the DEA use Title 21 authority, be granted Title 21 authority to surveil protesters. We're still working on that one. There's a lot more that needs to be done here, just really in kind of a holistic way. We get very focused, a lot of folks get very focused on the 702 authority, and for good reason. But it's hardly the only way that the government at multiple levels is essentially violating our rights and conducting unlawful surveillance and even, I would describe, COINTELPRO type political disruption activities against groups and individuals. So we're going to continue to work this at Cato indefinitely, at least certainly as long as I'm here.
Patrick Eddington is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast basically anywhere you like. And thank you for listening.